all it takes is a seed of doubt, like, oh, wait, maybe they're right. Maybe all of these Black people that have been saying this for years, maybe they're actually right. Let me read up about it. That's all it takes. It might take years, but that's all it takes. But if you don't have a teachable spirit, then you're never going to acknowledge that you benefit from white supremacy.
Hello and welcome to The Voracious Student. I'm Dania Milambert. This episode features Zakiya Young, a wonderful actress who has done everything in her career, Broadway, TV and film, lots of regional plays and musicals. We did a production of White Christmas years ago where we played Bob and Betty. She was the only Black actress, I believe, to have played Betty in White Christmas and also Lois Lane in Superman, which we talk about. Zakiya has been a key resource for me in this time, learning more about race, and that's really what this episode is all about. She is an incredible woman, and this conversation was so helpful and wonderful, and I just loved seeing her face again. You can't see her face, but I got to see her face. Enjoy. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice to see your smiling face.
Oh my gosh, it's been ages. I'm just so happy to see you. It's crazy. It's almost like when you play opposite someone in a romantic role, it almost feels like an ex, but like an amicably parted ex, you know? It's like, oh, it just didn't work out, but I'm still so happy to see them.
Totally. And you know, that was my first serious romantic role. So
I feel like you
kind of took me by the hand and said, this is how we do it, you know?
Well, you know, you were, that experience was, man, there were so many things happening and we were out in the middle of nowhere, Syracuse in the winter. Ooh, but you know, it was a beautiful production and I'm so glad I got to do it with you.
So you live in LA now and you used to live in New York. Tell me about that. Why did you make the move?
Well, why did I make the move? You know, I just felt like I needed a life. I had no quality of life in New York. My whole life was about jobs. When's the next job? And I was paying all this rent to work regionally 3/4 of the year. So it was just kind of like feeling disconnected. And, you know, once you've been on Broadway, it's like you're in the Broadway community, but you're not working on Broadway. So it's that weird thing of, am I happy with where my life is right now? And how can I change it? And, you know, I started thinking about LA when I did my last, when I did Disgraced, because I met up with some LA folks and I was like, okay, maybe I should check this out. And when I came to visit, it just felt like there was a better quality of life for actors because the seasons are so different. It's like there's pilot season, then there's episodic season. So you still have to build a life. You can't just rely on auditioning, and then you get something. So I feel like, you know, you can have a backyard and sunshine. And that's kind of what I wanted.
Well, you're smiling.
I am smiling. I didn't realize I'd been frowning for so long. But when I moved here, I literally felt my face just relax and my shoulders went down. And I was like, okay. And it's not for everybody. Don't get me wrong. Like, I've had plenty of friends who come here and are like, I hate it. But for me, it was a great fit.
Yeah, I was doing a job there a few years ago. And I was always that New Yorker who was like, I'm never going to LA. But I spent a couple weeks there and I said, you know, there's something to be said for this. But then when the show closed and then it was the day, I had experienced a day being sort of unemployed in LA and I got 2 parking tickets in the same day. And I said, the universe is trying to tell me something. Go home.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you do have to pay attention to the parking. I got 1 parking ticket and I was like, never again. I'm going to be like militant about where I park. And I didn't have a car for my first 4 months here, but I was like, you know what? I'm willing to make it work and we're going to see. So yeah, it's home now, which is crazy.
I love that. So you have been doing a lot of amazing Instagram lives. Listeners, I urge you to go listen to Zakiya, learn from Zakiya. You said in one of the ones recently that you feel like part of your calling is to speak about race.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. You know, when everything started happening with more of a spotlight being drawn to the killings of unarmed Black people at the hands of police, you know, most Black folks were just tired. And we're like, oh, now everybody's interested? We've been saying this for years. Eric Garner, you know, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, Sandra Bland. And this is the one. But yeah. Then after I got over my frustration at all of my newly woke friends, I realized, well, there's no distractions right now. Everybody's at home. You have a case that is so clear cut that nobody can argue with it, because usually, you know, the victims are put on trial after they're dead. But with George Floyd, it was like there was irrefutable evidence that everything was wrong. You would have the most conservative people that would admit, like, yeah, that was excessive. So as I started seeing some conversations on Facebook and whatnot, I was like, you know, gosh, I grew up in an all-white area, well, predominantly white. And I have a lot of friends that are close friends that are asking me questions and are saying that, like, I'm doing a good job of explaining what life is like for some Black Americans. And I was like, you know what? I feel like I need to do this more often, even though it exhausts me. And when I did my first video, it hit like 10,000 views on Facebook, which is more than any of my singing ever did. It was passed like from friends to other friends to people I don't know. And I'm getting messages from complete strangers. So I was like, all right, there's something to this. And then the Pass the Mic happened, where I took over Kelly O'Hara's Instagram page. And that just kept putting me on this journey that I had never anticipated being on.
You did what, three? Was it three or four interviews that day?
I did four interviews that day.
Yeah.
Wilkie, Diedrich, Zanya, and Bezad. And then Kelly and I did a follow-up where she and I just sat and talked. And
that's great.
She kind of processed all of the things that we discussed. Yeah. It was awesome. It was a lot, but it was an awesome day. And I'm very much the type of person, like, if you're not open to having the conversation, cool, you be over there. Good luck. God bless. But if you have questions, you can ask me. We can talk about it. I'm not always going to be accessible, but I will set aside time at least once a week to go on Instagram Live and talk about what's on my heart and be open for questions.
It's not always that I even have questions. It's just that every single story I hear sort of just cracks it open a bit. Because as I'm reviewing how I was raised, I think I was just taught everyone is equal, you know, which is a sentiment, but it makes you blind to what's actually going on. And, you know, I just think I bought into this idea that if I believed everyone was equal, then I wasn't racist.
Right.
While not being shown how the society is completely racist. So of course I'm racist. Of course I'm racist.
Well, and also I think there's, I think that people have to be willing to hear, because I've explained to some of my Black friends as well, who are having all of these discussions all of a sudden. You have to remember, people's whole mindset, what they have been raised believing, is being blown wide open. And it's not for lack of us telling them. There's just more of a willingness to hear now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think I give grace for people who are having a hard time with it, or who are still doubtful that the world really is how Black folks say it is for us. But I also realize that I can't expect anyone to know what my experience is unless I'm completely honest with you. And I have grown up shielding white people from my truth. Unless we start dating, we don't talk about that. Like, I think maybe when we work together, I might've mentioned how there are like no black people in Syracuse, except for like the athletes on campus. But we didn't really go into depth other than like how it affected the story, having a black sister and a white sister. But like, I didn't talk about the everyday things I went through. It just, you know, we have been socialized as black people to keep white people comfortable. We were brought here to do that. And it's in our DNA. And socially, we're punished if we don't do that, and we're rewarded if we do. And now it's like the whole system is being disrupted. And a bunch of us are like, well, welcome. Yeah. All right, let's have the talk. And I now have friends that I've been very open and honest with that are now having those hard conversations with their family and friends, which is the goal.
Yeah.
Because I cannot say certain things to your family and friends. And if a black person calls me out on something, especially a black person from the suburbs, it's going to land differently than if a white person that is friends of a friend drops knowledge about racism, systemic racism.
Yeah.
But if you have somebody in your family that's calling you out on microaggressions, racist jokes, you know, stuff like that, it's going to plant a seed, and it's probably going to lead to a lot of arguments, but they're going to remember that. So that's what I like to see myself as doing, like equipping allies to go have those conversations with your family and friends so that the truth can get out there. Because they're not going to listen, you know, to me.
Right.
You know.
I mean, one thing I definitely have learned in this period, which seems so obvious, I guess I just never really put it together, is that black people understand people better than white people understand black people. You are trained to understand us.
From birth, we have to. If we don't, we're punished in the classroom. The kids that are punished are usually the kids not only from difficult home situations, but if they don't make the world more comfortable for their white counterparts, they're punished. And there are studies about it. You know, black people are punished, black kids are punished at a much higher rate than white kids for the same things. Black kids are not allowed to be kids. We're seen as adults. And because of that, from the time that we're very small, we learn how to code switch. So if you heard me around my cousins or around some of my black friends, the dialect is very different. There's just a different energy. And I've learned that to be successful in predominantly white spaces, I cannot do that. Mm-hmm. But now it's like the veil is torn. But yeah, we're, you know, I think that's the fascinating thing about our industry. I was watching this, what is it? It's the series on Netflix with a lot of black directors and actors and designers. And one of the directors, her name's escaping me, she directed Eve's Bayou. She said, it's fascinating that black people literally have studied white folks and we still cannot direct all white movies without it being a fight. Whereas you'll have white directors directing black movies and it's not even a second thought. But yeah, we know exactly how to bob and weave, and y'all don't even know we're doing it, which is what we were raised to do.
The other thing you said about white people calling out microaggressions when they hear them in this time of reflection, I mean, that has been the thing that I'm like, I have not done enough of. And the memories have just come flooding back. I am sure I have committed many microaggressions. I want to say that very clearly. Mm-hmm. But that's not what's been at the forefront of my brain. The memories that have come flooding back are all the time something has been said where I just sort of freeze in my very polite Canadian way, which reminds me of, you know, all the things I felt as a queer person growing up. Just freeze. Yeah. Just don't go there.
Yeah. It's the whole talk to your cousins movement. Because as I said in my last video, I honestly think most people are good, but they don't realize what they're doing. So I have a friend who was telling me about a disagreement she had with another friend. And I was like, well, he was hurt by what you said because you actually know him. So there's this whole ideology of white liberals where it's like, well, I'm not one of those racists. I'm not racist. I voted for Obama. I have a black friend. I read Michelle Obama's book. It's like all of these well-meaning things, but it's like, but at your core, do you actually have black people over to your house? Do you watch black shows on TV? Do you clutch your purse if you're walking past a group of black people? How would you feel if all of a sudden there were a lot of black and brown kids coming to the elementary school where your kids are?
Yeah.
It's things like that. And we need to police each other with the same care that we do now for the LGBTQ community. That same care that goes into taking sexism out of our speech and for making workplaces safe against sexual harassment, that same care needs to go with protecting black people.
Yeah.
Because these sometimes going to work, it's like exhausting emotionally because of all the microaggressions that just go back and forth. And nobody recognizes it or even gives it a second thought. And that's something that came up in Disgraced. The black character is the only one that doesn't get a huge emotional release. The other characters have their moment.
That's
and
right.
Every night I would go home and just, I'd either drink or I'd exercise or I'd go on a date. I've literally had all of these insults being slung in my direction and the body doesn't know it's not real. My mind knows it's not real, but it still has an effect. So words are powerful. And I think if we start to acknowledge that, okay, we have to change so many things that we thought were okay or that we let slide because we want to protect our black friends and colleagues and make it safe for everybody, especially in the theater.
Especially in theater.
Was doing Disgraced ultimately a good experience?
Oh, yeah.
I love that
absolutely.
Play.
It was a pivotal experience for me in my growth. And I don't know that there's another play where I would get the opportunity to work with actors of Indian descent. So that was lovely. But it did, you know, when you're cast in a role, there's a piece of you that actually is that role. So basically, all of us were playing amplified versions of ourselves. So that did start spilling over into our personal relationships, you know, and I will say it took me a while to come out of that space and remember, okay, these people are my friends and they are my colleagues. And this play was this play, but I need a break. I need a good couple months to just step away from it and to let go of all of that energy and tension. But I will say it was amazing to see how audiences reacted to it. Mm-hmm. I went to most of the talkbacks in Chicago and I went to a handful of them in Berkeley and then I stopped because it was just, speaking of microaggressions, what you would get were people arguing that my character was not a real depiction of black women in corporate America. And I was like, excuse me, I was a black woman in corporate America before I became an actress. So this is a very accurate depiction, basically playing myself.
I lived it.
But seriously, it was like people would argue with how the play ended, basically saying that my character had no reason to be upset, basically trying to make my character the villain. It was fascinating the way people were bobbing and weaving to make jury responsible for what happened. No, I'm going home. I did my show.
Self-care.
I'm going home. Because I have to remember I'm representing myself and I want to work at these theaters again. So
yeah.
Let me just go home and chill out. Yeah.
So you're the first black actress to play Lois Lane.
Yes. Yes
I'm also,
yes.
I don't know if you know, do you know the website About the Artists? I don't use it a lot, but they have a feature.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's great because it has sort of everything, regional, Broadway, but you can actually put in a character name. and it'll show you everyone who's ever played it. So I suspected it. Yeah, I suspected it, but I put in Betty Haynes last night, and I'm pretty sure you are also the only Black actress to play Betty Haynes.
Betty's fun. I liked her.
She was fun. So could you talk to the listeners and I a little bit about that, entering a show like that, where maybe that casting is unexpected? Did you pursue roles, anything that came up around it?
Well, when the audition for Lois came in, I was in LA for my birthday and I laughed. I remember I was in the hotel room with my sister and her soon to be husband. And I was like, they called me in for Lois Lane. This is crazy. Like, thanks, Tara Rubin. I love you for always calling me in for everything I'm right for, but this is a long shot. So I emailed my agents and I said, I'm out of town. I can't make it. They wrote back and they were like, well, they'll see you on the callback when you get back. And I was like, okay. So I remember I waited till the last minute to do my work because I was just like, this is not a real thing. So I did my scenes, I learned the song, and then I watched The Philadelphia Story, which is the reference point they made for what Lois is going to be like, because we were going to do it era-specific, late 30s, early 40s. And when I went in, you know, it was a bunch of white girls, little white girls. I'm 5'10", so little white girls, very spunky character types. And I just kind of walked in, did my thing, and left. I was like, all right, I guess Charles Strauss liked it because he banged on the table after I finished singing, but I don't know what that means. So cool. And I forgot about it. And when my agents tricked me in the best way to get me to the office to tell me I got the job, I was so shocked, started crying. I was just like, this is amazing. And after the excitement, then the fear set in. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, okay, I know there are going to be naysayers that say, oh, she just got it because they wanted a Black Lois Lane. And it was happening in Dallas, Texas. It's like, wow, we can't have a sensible like LA or...
Yeah, right.
You know, and I felt like I had a lot to prove. And it didn't help that there were some people in the cast that were up for the role that I ultimately got. I mean, that's uncomfortable regardless, but especially when you are, I don't think there were any other Black women in the cast. There was two Black men, but I was the only Black woman in the cast. And it was my first leading role. So it was a lot of firsts and I felt such a responsibility, like, all right, Z, you gotta kill this. Like you can't have a bad show. So it was tough. I got a lot of support, especially from the director, Kevin Moriarty, and our book writer, Roberto. And Roberto would he went to bat for me in the press with the New York, I think it was the New York Times or Variety. I think it was the New York Times article about our show. And he really went to bat for me, which I appreciated, still do. But yeah, it was a lot. There was a lot of entitlement among white actresses over their role. But Superman's an alien and it's a comic book.
Right. What is this world? Right. Yeah.
Right. Like, okay, I'm not sorry that I booked a role, but I need you to check your privilege because every role. So with that mindset, you're basically saying Black actresses can only audition for Black roles. Asian actresses, same thing. If we're going to do that, then gay actors and actresses can only audition for gay roles. Like it doesn't even make sense. And the entitlement, it's like people don't even realize it.
I love what you said in one of your videos that you like, you have to stop saying, oh, they went ethnic. They decided to go ethnic.
Yes.
Like it's just, and I can tell you also, I heard that a lot. I would hear that from past agents, not my current agent, past agents. And so you start saying what you hear as well.
Yeah. And if it's coming from your reps, I mean, my gosh. So it's like, okay, let me get this straight.
And you know they're representing non-white people as well.
Exactly. So I'm like, so what you're saying to your white client is, I didn't get any feedback as to why you didn't book it. So I'm going to say they went ethnic. And for your Black clients, it's just, well, they went in a different direction. So the agents and the managers have been feeding this entitlement as well among white actors. That's something I have to talk about with my agents and managers, making sure that they're willing to submit me for all types of roles, not just roles written for Black people, because especially in musical theater, there's a new generation of composers and lyricists that are writing better roles for women of color, but you know, it's still a journey. It's still a journey, but I'm glad to see that more people are recognizing that there is a lack. I'm glad that more new composers and lyricists are getting funding for their projects. But yeah, it's very problematic. And I definitely have to have a team where they're willing to put me up for the roles that I'm not right for, quote unquote, on paper.
Yeah, I have a vague memory of when we were doing the show together, you saying that you had that understanding with your reps.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's harder out here in LA because I'm still new. Mm-hmm. But that is something that is at the forefront of every conversation. I was raised in the suburbs, period. So unless there is I feel like in television and film, there are more stories about Black suburban people. Yes, I'm an actress. I can play any type of role, but I visit the hood. I don't live there. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I can do it, but I'm not the essence necessarily.
That's why you're so good in Good People, too.
Thank you.
Such a
I loved her.
Lovely in that show. And I love that play.
Kate was one of my favorite roles to play because I read her and I instantly knew her. I instantly knew her. And I was shocked. I was shocked by how accurate the lines were. I was like, David Lindsay Abaire, does he have a Black wife? I was like, who told him all of the secrets? But it was just so amazing. So I'm hoping that the industry will not see this as just a trend, but that the way you talk to your white clients, the way you talk to your Black clients, the way that actors talk about roles they really wanted to check their privilege. That's all. Because you deserve nothing in this industry. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nobody deserves anything.
Nobody owes you anything. Yeah.
Yeah. At all.
And how did you feel when you get called in for Betty?
Confused.
Again,
confused. But then when I walked in and saw that there was a Black artistic director, I was like, oh, okay. We got somebody thinking outside the box. And I, again, did not think I would get it. I was like, this would be great, but all right. And when I got that one, I was like, oh, snap, this is happening. Okay. Because I had never watched the movie. Some Black people grew up with White Christmas. I was not one of those families. I was like, why am I watching a bunch of white people singing in blackface?
Hello. Hello.
Like, there's
no,
a whole
thank you.
Blackface number. So I tried watching it once and I was like, this is some nonsense. I'm not watching this. But getting to do the show and getting to know the music, I was like, okay, this is quite lovely and charming. The film is problematic, but I like what we're doing here. But yeah, I definitely didn't think I had a shot. And I will say there are several casting offices in New York that call me in for anything regardless of race. And Tara Rubin, Stuart Whitley, Carnahan casting, like they always, without regard for race, I know that when I open up the audition appointment, it could be anything. And I love that because I feel like I'm seen as a person. I'm not seen as a Black person. I'm seen as a person who is talented and fits the energy and the essence of the character and the breakdown.
Right. I mentioned to you by email that there were some microaggressions in that production that I didn't speak up for. We don't have to talk about those. I tell you as a friend that in this time, I've sort of felt bad about it and been like, I just wish I'd stood up for you more.
Well, I appreciate and love you and thank you for saying that. I just ask that you pay it forward. Because honestly, microaggressions happen so often. I've honestly forgotten what even happened. Like, it's I've completely forgotten. Like, I remembered having, conversations about how we would justify the sisterhood, but it's like, oh, right, transracial adoption is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. So this absolutely, and we had a cast member who is a Black girl, well, woman now, raised by a white family. So
yes, I remember that.
And this,
this can happen.
And that totally, totally. But
I mean, I think things that also don't happen when you're in the room, and they're very, very subtle, but just the way people speak about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, it's a lot, but I hear that.
It's a lot. And I think that, again, we can change the culture with the way, like, even from my time being a professional actress, the way gay marriage is spoken about, there's been such a change. Such mm-hmm. a change. It's been so embraced and celebrated, which is how it should be. So I want to use that same momentum and apply it to Black folks, you know, all people of color, really, because like, I know my Asian colleagues have tons of microaggressions they deal with as well. I can only speak to the Black ones personally. But I think that acknowledging it is the first step. And when you know better, you do better.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, most Black folks are so tired. I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, yeah, if there's a microaggression, if I really care about you, I'll call it out. If you're a complete stranger that I'm just working with, it really depends on how closely we have to work together. Because I have so much else going on. I don't have time to break it down for you. You know?
Yeah. I just had a thought. I don't know if this is true, but I also feel like microaggressions against one group can help feed another. And what I mean by that is there were so many microaggressions against me as a gay man studying musical theater, especially in the time I studied it. It was 15 years ago. It was mm-hmm. a very different game, but it was very clear that the straight men were glorified and that essentially the more I could pass as straight, the more respected I would be in the school mm-hmm. and the more I could succeed in life. And so where I'm going with that is that it really made me shine my light on my gayness almost exclusively and make me blind mm-hmm. to what was going on around me.
And I think that's common for white gay men as well as white women. Mm-hmm. You get stuck in a space of your own injustice and suffering that you make it your focus and you don't have room to empathize with or fight for anybody else. And what I saw, especially among, and I did a video with Brett and Steven.
Yes.
About,
I actually just watched it just this morning.
With,
it was great.
We need to have another one of those. But I did notice a drop off of social justice posts from my white gay friends. And I was like, wait a minute. We were all together for marriage equality. And now we need you as Black folks and you're not there.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. But again, when you know better, you do better. I mean, that's Black women. We have a double-edged sword, but I think that nobody has a harder time, I'm just guessing, than Black trans men. Because if you were given the gender assignment at birth as a woman and you're a Black woman and then you transition into your true identity, you've gotten it from both sides now. And now there's this added layer. So I completely empathize.
Yes.
I know how I feel as a Black straight woman. My mind is blown, with what the trans community must go through. And there's so much intersectionality that is ignored when it comes to Black people. You know, the March on Washington with the women wearing their pink hats, how many Black women were there? You know, whenever Black women bring up things that are specific to our experience as Black women, we're told, well, why are you bringing race into this?
Yeah.
Stop making everything so racial or political. And it's like, but I can't separate myself from being Black any more than I can separate myself from being a woman. So either you see me as the whole or you don't see me at all.
Yeah, I've seen so much of that in the gay community. A memory I've had recently, it's, you know, it was brief, but I remember being at a college party and I was flirting with a black guy and I was really into it. And some white guy kind of pulled me over and very subtly just said, "I'm trying to save you from the black man." And I remember thinking, "I don't need saving. Thank you very much. I don't need saving." And that's where I was. But in my buttoned up Canadian-ness, I realized that that was not how I felt. And yeah. I remember thinking he was out of turn, but I didn't even identify it as racist, really. Like, mm-hmm. I knew I didn't think like that. I knew I didn't feel like that. I wanted to mm-hmm. kiss that mm-hmm. guy that night. And I did.
Yeah.
But, yeah. but yeah, so many. And that was what, a 5-second interchange.
And isn't that interesting that it's a white gay man trying to save you from a black gay man? That privilege right there is bananas. All black people want is equality. It's not to say that everyone is down with interracial relationships, and I'm actually going to do an IG live about that very topic, but it's for different reasons that people are against it. It's a fascinating discussion, and all of the reasons people are against it are based in fear on both sides. Fear, 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 fear. And that's a whole different discussion. I'm like, I got thoughts of Emmett Till and just there's such a history, a complicated history with interracial relationships because we didn't have a choice when we were brought here. If a white person wanted to have sex with us, we were raped. You know, have I found love as an adult with white men? Yeah, I have, but it's a process and it's not for the faint of heart. And some of the most quote unquote liberal people, loving people, Christian people have a lot to say about it that's not in favor of it. And that's a problem.
Yeah. It's some of those subtle things that I think are the hardest to dismantle because you can, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of that in Canada. It's not outright.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the very first things I did when this all started going down, there were all these books being recommended. And I said, mm-hmm. the first thing I want to read is I need to read about Canada because I don't fully understand if the problem is as bad up there. I suspect it is, but I need some facts.
Yeah.
And it took me about 10 pages to figure out that it's just more veiled.
Exactly. Because when I keep seeing some black folks posting about we're moving to Canada, I'm like, yo, it's no better up there because I was married to a Canadian guy.
And they won't even
racism
talk about it.
Racism is real. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, unless it's brought into your space and you have to face it, then it's discussed very politely, but you still feel it. I was the only black person in my ex's hometown when we would go visit his family. The only black person. And he was like, well, I think we have a Chinese family and they own the Chinese restaurant, but that's it. And, you know, they were educating me about the First Nations issues. And I was just like, y'all are literally just like America. You're just quiet.
Yeah. I think there are people waking up there too. One of the incredible things, when I read the book, there were all these stories that I'd never heard of. I said, how have I never heard of these stories that happened 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago? So I Googled them. And not only did I find them, but I found almost in every single case, protest about this thing from 4 years ago happened yesterday. Reopening of the case. Like people are just now up there.
Yep. Yeah. It's like, well, now that your eyes are opened, this has been happening for years. So now that we're willing to re-examine what happened and make sure that liberty and justice for all is for all people in America, even though that was written when black people weren't considered people, we were considered property. Well, that's changed. So now, are you going to be consistent with who gets justice or not? Like, there's a case of a guy serving a life sentence for stealing a pair of hedge clippers in Louisiana. There are so many laws that were created to keep Black people enslaved. That it's ridiculous. If you start to do a deep dive, your mind is going to be blown. But my first step in my education was watching 13, the documentary by Ava DuVernay. So good. And I was like, wait a minute. you know, because we're taught, well, if you do something bad, then you have to go to jail. Okay. But when I see white people doing the same thing and not getting the same punishment, you literally have people that can come into apartments of black people and shoot them, shoot black people dead while they sleep, or shoot black people dead in their own residence and get off with light sentences, or maybe not even be arrested. Natalie Holloway, why do we all know her name? I'm sorry that she was killed. We all know her name because she is the epitome of the all-American girl, blonde hair, blue eyed, right?
Yeah.
Her face was everywhere, everywhere. There are white murder victims are made famous and memorialized. And there is such an urgency to find out who killed them, to arrest them and bring them to justice. And the same thing doesn't happen when black people are killed. Breonna Taylor, she was killed how many months ago? And no arrests have been made. I saw a post that said more people have been arrested for protesting Breonna than have been arrested for killing her. It's crazy. And there's a black DA too.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other conversation.
Right. Which, yeah. I think to finish, we're taking a deep dive into race in this episode, but the overall theme of this podcast is learning. And you said something that I think is absolutely genius in one of your videos, which is there is an unteachable spirit based on white supremacy.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
Well, it's the kind of thing that unless you open up your heart to accepting responsibility and to seeing life through another person's eyes, if you're not willing to do that, there is literally nothing I can tell you that's going to change your mind. All it takes is a seed of doubt, like, oh, wait, maybe they're right. Maybe all of these black people that have been saying this for years, maybe they're actually right. Let me read up about it. That's all it takes. It might take years, but that's all it takes. But if you don't have a teachable spirit, then you're never going to acknowledge that you benefit from white supremacy. And here's the honest thing. If white people are so much greater than other races, then why wouldn't you want everyone to have equal access so that you can prove your superiority? Do you know what I mean? Like, that's always puzzled me because I'm like, we'll level the playing field so that we can all compete. But you're saying that you're smarter and you're more upstanding moral creatures and that you can do things so much better than black folks. All right, well, give us a chance to audition, to interview, give us the business loan so that we can start the business. But no, you want to, there's this mentality of fear and lack. So it's like people with the unteachable spirits don't want anybody else to have access.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest problem. And I think it goes back to how this country was founded. It was already occupied by people.
Yeah.
The explorers came here and were like, well, we got to have this for ourselves. We can't ask to be on this land and we can't do business with the people, with the Native Americans who are already here. We have to completely overpower them. And you know what? When we were in Africa and we saw all of these really strong people who know how to do all kinds of things, let's subdue them and let's bring them all over to America to work for us. I think it's fascinating that like you'll read narratives about slave owners on their deathbed, either realizing they were wrong or finally acknowledging some of their kids that were conceived through rape as descendants and giving them rights as descendants. And it's like, gosh, it took you that long, but you finally had that realization. But again, if you are unwilling to consider that maybe you didn't get the job because you were mediocre, maybe you didn't get the job because you didn't prepare, or maybe you just weren't a good fit for it, period. all of the other things that you grant other white people the benefit of the doubt with, if you don't get something, you should be granting to other people, to people of color.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a spirit where you can acknowledge that, oh my gosh, I actually did get a leg up because of that.
Yeah. I thought in this time too, you know, I mean, we all know this is a very hard business, but I was like, wouldn't it be nice to feel like I absolutely earned this on a level playing field? You know?
Yeah.
Like, quite frankly, I feel like there's a lot of white people going right now, oh God, am I not going to get as much work? And I'm like, maybe, mm-hmm. or maybe you have to fight harder.
Maybe.
Work, you know, maybe, but.
Work harder.
Right.
But also accept that the business is the business and you're not always going to work. And please don't complain to your Black friends that only ethnic people are getting the roles now. Like I've had so many people tell me to my face, well, I don't work now because I'm white. And all I can do is just look at you. Wow, you don't even realize what you're saying. And I don't care to explain it to you because you've already shown me where you are. Good luck. God bless. That's a deep dive I'm not willing to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would encourage your listeners to see if there's any truth to anything that we've been talking about. And if there is just a flicker of truth or something that twinges you in your spirit, if you're listening to this and you're defensive, but there's something that's like, oh, examine that. And it's okay. Black people are not mad at white people for having privilege. You didn't decide what race you were going to be born.
Right.
So it's a matter of what you're going to do with it. And will you dismantle it so that we can all have the same opportunities? That's it. Nobody's mad at you for being born white.
Yeah. And I think even just a tiny crack or a tiny bit of curiosity can start a change, can start a snowball.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't have to be an epiphany. It can just be, wait, I never quite thought of that. Let me just run with that idea. And they would know better. So why don't I just give them the benefit of the doubt?
Yes. Maybe I should read one of these books, or maybe I should like watch someone other than Oprah. Or if I'm gonna watch Oprah, let me watch her conversations about racism. Because once people become famous and they're Black, everyone likes to think, well, they're beyond race. They're above race. No, they're not. Take away all that makeup and money and they are still Black. Beyonce was always Black. Michael Jordan, Black. Michael Jackson, Black. You know, it's like that saying that I've been seeing, they love our rhythm, but they don't love our blues. You can't just appropriate Black culture without acknowledging where it comes from. Our artistic forms are birthed out of a lot of pain and a lot of suffering, and we still find ways through it. You know, so yeah, just consider that maybe Black folks know what they're talking about. And don't try to be the authority on this. I think that's the hardest thing for white men, gay and straight, to understand. You're not going to be an authority on this. You're just not. So please let the people speak that know what they're talking about and learn from it and see what you can do to help dismantle racism from your position of privilege. There was a guy I dated, a great guy for a short amount of time, but a wonderful guy. And I had said, I'm not dating any more white guys because y'all take too, there's too much for me to teach and I'm tired. And he said, look, I know that I'm a straight white man. I'm at the top of the food chain. And he said, so it's my job as a white man who loves people and loves Jesus to use my privilege to help start dismantling racism on behalf of my brothers and sisters of color. Now, his was from a Jesus perspective, but just from a human perspective.
Yeah.
That should be, that's what I would love to see. I'm hoping that we're still working on this, that we're further along in a year. I hope it's not a trend, but I'm not going to say I'm pessimistic about it, but we'll see.
I think that's really fair. And it's a different headspace if you are in it for the long term. Mm-hmm. I think white people have to be really real with themselves. If am I actually in this for the long term, and what does that look like?
Yes.
You know,
and am I doing work on my own, or am I just expecting Black people to do all the work for me?
And so, am I looking like I'm doing the work, or am I actually doing the work? I mean, it's, you know, yes, especially when we're all quarantined at home and with social media, it's tricky because, I mean, I don't see everyone face to face, but I had this intuition that a lot of my white friends are doing really good work and it doesn't look like it on social media at all. And there are people who look like major allies in social media who are not doing nearly as much as it might seem like. Yep. And everything in between.
Everything in between. Yeah. So it's just a matter of like, look, I'm not saying call up all your Black friends and apologize or ask, what can I do to help? Google exists. Use it. And then once you've started doing the work, then come to me with your questions. You know what I mean? It's like white women are so good at organizing and dismantling things that do not work for them. So you can do some research on white privilege and then come into the discussion with facts and not just feelings.
Zakiya, I love you.
I love you too.
Thank you for doing this, and thank you for everything you are doing.
And thank you for having me on for the conversation. I love getting to expose different groups of people to something they may not have thought of, you know? So thank you for doing this.
Absolutely.
And that was my episode with Zakiya. If you haven't yet, please take a chance to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It really helps me grow it. Stay safe, take care of each other, and I'll talk to you soon.